If you found this podcast, chances are you're a high achiever and you're successful. But now you're stuck and stressed, and you realize that everything you've created hasn't given you the fulfillment and the joy you thought it would. This is where we discuss the keys of high performance mindset and stepping into the next best version of yourself. Welcome to the Positive Persistence Podcast. Welcome back to another episode of the Positive Persistence Podcast, where we bring you stories to inspire you and strategies to help you tap into your potential and become your best self. I had the opportunity to meet and hear today's guest speak about, I think it was a year ago, almost to the day. And I was enamored by his story and his ability to seemingly look into people's soul. And that's for real. He's a podcast host, business leader, keynote speaker, human behavior, and success coach whose purpose in life is to share his truth to give others permission to live theirs. Brian Bogert, welcome to the show.
Ian, my man, I'm so excited to be here with you. We were just talking with you and Dana right before, and obviously we've been trying to make this happen for close to a year, and I'm a big believer that the timing is always perfect when we allow it, and I just think the universe maybe wasn't ready for us yet. So today's going to be a blast, and certainly appreciate, too, given what I know about you, your story, and how you show up in the world, your words are very kind. And my friend, I'm grateful to be here with you.
Well, I definitely appreciate you. And I know that our listeners and our viewers are going to get something out of this conversation. And I will echo what I said before, you know, just hearing you speak at our mutual friend Amberly Lago's Unstoppable Summit last year, I was blown away. Like, my mouth was on the floor, and you just have a way of connecting with people and reading them. And well, let's just get into it, because I don't want to spill the beans, right? So just to kind of dive in for our listeners and our viewers, you lived through an extraordinarily, I guess, early in life trauma, and you had to have numerous surgeries. And that was hoping that you could kind of open this conversation up by sharing with us today a little bit about that story, and then how that personally, or how that your personal journey really shaped your view on pain, resilience, and eventually performance.
That's a big question to tackle in one answer, but I'm going to do the best I can to hit on every piece. I'll take you back just really to the beginning. And it was August 10th, 1992. It was about 6 to 6:15 p.m. in the evening on a 115-degree day. And my mom, my brother, and I went to our local Walmart just to get a 1-inch paintbrush. And anybody who's known me for more than about 2 minutes knows that I walk fast, I talk fast. I've always had this excitement and vigor for life. So not a big surprise to my mom or anybody else that I was the first one to the car. Why? Because I wanted to get home and put that paintbrush to use. I wanted to see what we were going to do with it. And as I got to the car, put my hand on the handle and started to wait for my mom to catch up to unlock the doors, because this was back in the days before there was key fobs. So I had to wait for her to literally reach her hand in the purse, grab her keys, stick it in the door, turn it so we could go on with our way. And it took longer for her to get to the car than I think we all were expecting. But my mom and brother were only a few feet behind me. And as I got to the car, a truck pulled up in front of the store, and the driver and the middle passenger parked and got out. Passenger all the way to the right felt the truck moving backwards. So Ian, he did what any one of us would do, and he scooted over to put his foot on the brake. But he instead hit the gas. And combination of shock and force threw him up on the steering wheel, up on the dashboard. And before you know it, he's catapulting 40 miles an hour across the parking lot right at me with no time to react. Goes up and over the median, goes up and over the tree in the median, hits our car, knocks me over, runs over me diagonally, tearing my spleen, leaving a tire track scar on my stomach, and continuing on to sever my left arm completely from my body. Now, as I said to you, it was August 10th, 115-degree day. My mom and brother watched the entire thing happen. And the next thing my mom hears is my brother's voice saying, "Mom, Brian's arm is over there." And as she gazes up to see where he's pointing, she sees a string of muscle cooking on the asphalt like hamburger. Now, I always pause here because obviously I'm here. And the only reason I'm here, other than my mom, is another woman who happened to be on site that day. It was a nurse who saw the literal life and limb situation when she walked out of the store. And she rushed immediately into action. Now, I've said for years that I was forever indebted to this woman for the choice that she made in that moment to come and help me.
Yeah.
And I met her for the first time 3 years ago on the 30th anniversary of the accident. And that point became even more real. Why? Because she had a friend with her there that day. Also a nurse. All the same sets of skills. All the same sets of training. But instead, she turned her head and went on her way. Now, I want to be clear with me. I have no resentment, no upset, no ill will, no negative feelings towards this other woman. That was well within her right to do. But why do I highlight the contrast of that? Because it does show that the power of a singular choice in a singular moment can have a ripple effect to not only save someone's life, but then impact hundreds of thousands, if not millions of others. And that's what this woman did for me. She came over and stopped the bleeding on the main wound and saved my life. And then she instructed some innocent bystanders to run inside, grab a cooler, fill it with ice, and get my detached limb on ice within minutes to give me a fighting chance of having a reattached arm. Now, we can go way deeper into all of the different elements of this question that you asked beside the story. Mm-hmm. And what I do ground with and what I want to start with before I say anything else is I realize how unique my story is. See, I've been telling it for a long time now. And I used to believe that this was my transformation story. We'll discover later, and I'll tell you and fill you in later, that it really was not my transformation story, but it was one that impacted me greatly. But what is important for me is that the more I've spoken on stage and the more I work with people, the more I realize that every single one of you has a unique story. Mm-hmm. So what becomes important is how do you learn to pause long enough to become aware of the lessons you can extract from your own stories so that you can become intentional in how you apply them in your lives moving forward. And I'm only here today to share my story in the hopes that it will help you tap into the collective wisdom of my experiences. Why? Because we can all learn from our own and we can all tap into the lessons of others to shorten our curve to learning. You know, the big piece that I'll say early on, Ian, and then we can unpack the other elements of resilience and pain, because again, I want to be thoughtful in the way that we go back and forth in this dialogue, is that I do remember at 7 and 8 years old laying in that hospital bed. Laying in the hospital bed feeling sorry for myself, wondering, why me? What's going to happen to me? What is this going to look like? And perspective hit me right in the face. And I do believe that perspective and pain always point us towards what's important if we're paying attention, right? It always gives us feedback. And so as I'm sitting here in this place and we're being overwhelmed with support of other families coming up to us from the ICU saying, we're so sorry for what happened to you. We're so sorry for what happened to you. How can we help? How can we help? And then come to find out that their kid's laying in the hospital bed next to me with a terminal illness and doesn't know if they're going to live for another 30 days. That was the moment that I realized that my life was no longer in jeopardy and whether or not my arm would be successfully reattached, which it was too early to tell at that point, or if I would ever actually regain function to the level that I do today, that became secondary, right? Because why? My life was secure and perspective again was important. And that was the moment that I decided that I was no longer going to allow myself to get stuck by the things that had happened to me, but instead get moved by what I can do with them. And that's how I live my life today, is that I believe that moved people move people. I'm just trying to move as many as I can. And I know we'll go much deeper into different components of this as we continue to talk, but that's kind of the tops of the waves, at least in the story. And, you know, there's lots of little ripple effects of impact that I didn't quite discover for 20, 25 years later.
As an 8-year-old boy laying in the hospital, I mean, that is pretty impressive. You know, way to start to deal with your situation. Because I think that, you know, I remember me at age 8, I also had a transformational experience, but it was nothing like that. But it was something that did change me and how I looked at myself and how I dealt with my environment. For a lot of people, we don't have that situation, that thing, that catalyst, that event that helps us make that transformation and how we deal with setbacks, how we deal with adversity, or how we deal with pain. So I'm just curious, and this is something that you've said, we need to embrace pain to avoid suffering. And I was hoping you could unpack that for us, because I know that's part of your message and that's something that you instill in your coaching.
Yeah, I'm going to focus on that. And then I think what might make some sense is also to come back and realize some of the elements that developed thought processes, limiting beliefs, and even a mindset that really propelled me forward. But this concept of embracing pain to avoid suffering, it certainly was something that happened by witness, and it took me years to realize the full impact of the lesson. Why? Because those 5 or 6 years post accident, I was in and out of surgeries. I was largely in a fog, right? And though I knew what was happening to me, and I did have lots of moments of real deep awareness, I was also 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. And so there's only so much perspective you can have at that age. I look at it now as a parent and I have a much deeper appreciation, because my parents in no way were in a fog, right? They were overly aware of the unceasing medical treatments, the years of physical therapy, right? The stacking medical bills and elements that were going to ultimately determine, is this the right thing? Is this not the right thing? What's going to give our son the best use? And, you know, in all honesty, when you look at how they lived their lives, and they've even discussed this with me in the last 5 to 10 years, the idea of seeing their son grow up without the use of his left arm was a source of great potential suffering for them. So they literally willed themselves day in and day out to do what was necessary, to do what was tough, to ultimately embrace the pains required to strengthen and heal me. So whether it was intentional or not, what they did was they ingrained in me this philosophy and this way of living, right? How many parents, sets of couples divorce after traumatic events that impact their family? my parents had active discussions, actually putting their minds and their hearts together to decide like, hey, the only way through this is together, right? Despite whatever turmoil we're going to go through as a result of it, right? They would make decisions to enable and empower me to not become dependent on them. But my mom would make me tie my own shoes with one hand or do something that was difficult. And she'd go around the corner and be in tears because she really wanted to help me and make it easy for me. But she also knew that if she made a different choice, I may not ever be able to have the independence or the ability to have faith in my ability to adapt to what was needed in front of me. Mm-hmm. So as much love and support and encouragement as I got, that's this philosophy came out of it. Now, let's understand the philosophy and how I apply it today, because this is what really matters, is we have to understand a couple things. One, we have to understand our nervous system. Why? Because our nervous system is hardwired to anticipate threat, risk, loss of life, right? And our bodies literally react. Why? Because it's there designed to keep us alive, to keep us safe. Mm-hmm. But 100 years ago, you could cut your leg and you could die. Whereas today, that's not really the current reality. Geez, 33 years ago, I had my arm torn from my body and it's reattached and I'm still here today, which shows that even in my lifetime, the medical advancements that exist don't put the loss of life in the same category that it once used to be. But what are we reacting to? We're often reacting to those emotional components that actually affect us or the beliefs that are ingrained in us that we don't quite know how to move through. Now, we also have to understand how we define pain. Pain is defined as short-term, intermittent, a direct cause from something, and alleviated once that direct cause is removed, right? But then what do we do as humans? We screw it up by putting adjectives in front of that word, which inherently change the definition, like acute and chronic. Now, chronic changes it completely because it implies that it's no longer short-term and it persists after the direct cause is removed. Acute is basically just doubling down and redundant because acute is, by definition, what pain is. So if chronic pain then doesn't fit, what is it? It's really suffering. And we don't want to admit that suffering exists, particularly when it's a direct result of our choices. But the unavoidable precursor to change, my friend, is acceptance. Until we accept the current state of things, we cannot begin to alter them. So what does this look like in application and practice? Yes. Well, we can embrace the pain of hitting the gym for 30 minutes a day to avoid the suffering of aches and pains from a sedentary lifestyle. We can embrace the pain of a difficult conversation with a loved one or spouse to avoid the suffering of being stuck in a loveless marriage or frankly, wanting to be able to create repair and not knowing how, right? We can embrace the pain of the fit our kids are sure to throw when we have them put down their mobile devices at the dinner table to avoid the suffering of years of lost meaningful connection and conversation that we'll never get back. As business owners, we can embrace the pain of firing our top salesperson to avoid the suffering of stagnation and losing all our other top talent because they were the greatest cancer in our culture. For me, I had to embrace the pain of the shame and the anger that actually existed in my life that I was unaware of for decades to avoid the suffering of living a life without my wife and my kids, which I almost lost as a result of me, right? When we actually think about what it is that we really, really want to be paying attention to, there's a few steps to frame this, and I won't go through all of them, but one of them really comes down to this, which is, look, we've been shown and we've scientifically proven that people are more motivated to avoid pain than they are to seek pleasure. But then what happens when people actually create business plans? They start to create visions. They create goals, right? First and foremost, most people set limiting goals that limit their own capacity, and they do it in a safe, protectionary way instead of actually going after what they really want, no matter how audacious it sounds. But the second piece is most goal setting only focuses on the top, the good, the reward, the pleasure, the outcomes that we want.
Of course, yeah.
And very rarely does it anchor the other bookend, which is identifying the suffering that you wish to avoid. Mm-hmm. See, not that I want to use pain as a motivator. That's not what I'm suggesting at all. But we need to understand this other piece, because if I wasn't clear on the suffering I wish to avoid, I would be here with you today as a single man, because I would not still be married. And I don't know how much access I would have to my kids, right? But I knew that suffering for me very clearly was a life without my wife and my kids, which means there is no pain I will not embrace to ensure that that can still remain true as long as it's in alignment with what my wife still wants, because that's still her choice as well, right?
Of course.
But outside of that, this is how I live my life. It's always coming down to choices,
yeah,
and questions so that I can have options and opportunities to make those choices, because I believe that we can choose the change we want, or we can choose to change when we don't want change. Either way, you've got to embrace the pain to avoid the suffering.
Either way, at the gym, we call that embracing the suck. But what I hear you saying, if I may, just to put it in, framing it in my words, that you need to understand the things that you don't want to happen, and you need to want them not to happen bad enough to take the action to make sure that they don't happen, so you can then achieve the things that you do want.
It's exactly right. I mean, look at it to the point of even when people decide to choose the change they want or to choose the change when they don't want change. It's whenever the suffering becomes big enough that they decide that it's worthwhile to do something else, right? Then they have to go through a process of actually identifying that pain that they need to learn to embrace. But yes, if we're not clear on that in the first place, then we're just replacing strategy and tactics. We're not creating aligned action in anything we do.
So what would you tell somebody that is not at that point to where they realize that they are in a point of suffering? They want to make the change, but they don't have the courage yet to embrace the pain, to make the change, to avoid the suffering. What would you say to that individual in terms of taking that first step to realizing what they need to do to embrace that pain?
I'll give a quick little example because it's one that I didn't have the full definition of suffering on, but it's a great example that related to my life that I think can be tangible. And this can apply to multiple different categories, but it was literally the nature of that. And it comes down to the questions that we ask ourselves. So part of my story and part of my dynamic, and though I'm in a really good place now, I lived with daily physical pain for nearly 31 years to the point that it was debilitating, quality of life impacting. And it was about 20 years ago that it started to get to a place where it was more than just that kind of mild numbing pain that was in the background, like really started to affect my life. And at that time, I started to then do some research and understand that if I kept a lean body, if I kept a strong core, if I ate well, if I stayed into movement, then most of the time I could mitigate the majority of the physical pain that I was in to something that was nominal and endurable. But what did I do? Well, I did. And by the way, this is true for like anybody around January, which is why we see all these trends. I was like, I went and I joined a gym. What did I do? By the way, Ian, I fucking crushed it for 30 days, bro. I brought it. Every single thing that I could do, sure. I was bringing it. And I was noticing the results. Mm-hmm. But here's the reality. After about 30 days, I stopped going. Now, up until that point, I would have replaced it with something else. Well, it must not be the right gym for me. I'll go hire a trainer. I'll join Orange Theory. I'll join a cycle gym or whatever, right? I would replace it with the strategy and the tactic. But in this case, I knew that I already had done that in prior periods, and yet my pain was still taking place, which meant to me consistency was more important than anything else, which meant 30 days consistent isn't going to get me there. It has to be something that becomes adopted into my lifestyle. And so I had to ask a different question. Is it the pain of the weights that I'm avoiding? Is it the plyometrics that I'm avoiding? Is it the stretching that I'm avoiding? Is it the getting up early and putting in additional time that I'm avoiding? No. What was I really avoiding? I was avoiding the anxiety and the shame that I had when I worked out in a crowded gym because everything I had to do was modified. And I hated when people looked at me when I was trying to figure out how to do it the first time. It wasn't that I didn't have the fundamentals of working out. It's that I don't have a tricep in my left arm. I don't have a bicep in my, or sorry, a lat on the left side of my body. My bicep is my gracilis from my leg, right? And so again, if I had just kept it in that, well, I've done a gym before. I'm going to go find something else. The question is, if you make changes or you decide that you are maybe not as clear in the suffering or wanting to have the courage to step in it, but you're not getting the results that you want or living the life that you want, then ask more questions. Right. And again, I go back to even what I said at the end last of the answer. The only time we get stuck in life, the only time we exist in waste, which is a core part of the waste to wealth methodology that we've developed and teach today, the only time is when we stop asking questions. So when we ask questions, again, it gives us options and opportunities to evaluate what our options are, to make new choices, get changes, take actions down those changes, and then we get feedback and the cycle begins over. But this roots down to like what my dad taught me is one of the most fundamental lessons that I teach today, which is that no matter what, always guaranteed in life, you will always have a minimum of two choices. Now, they both might be shitty choices. You could be held up at gunpoint. Your choice is to hand over all your worldly possessions or get shot, right? But the point is the power lies in your ability to have a choice. And even in that situation, what if you just asked one more question? What if you could meet that person where they are? Maybe they don't actually need what they're asking you for, but they are suffering. Could you get them support, services? Could you help modify that person? Can you establish whether or not they have a need beyond whatever they're holding you up for? Can you meet them with humanity in a way that can neutralize and diffuse this situation, which then inherently opens up more options? See, the issue is we look at everything in a binary way, right? And yet often, I don't believe that the world exists in black and white. It's all about contrast, and the gift is almost always in the gray. You only discover in the gray with the questions that you're willing to ask. And so you may not have the courage to take the actions. You may not have the courage to step into the pain yet, but you have the courage to ask yourself the questions. You have the courage to admit that you're not where you want to be or that there is something that you could change about yourself or in the actions that you take that would actually put you closer in alignment to who you are and what you want. And in the most simplistic sense, if you want to break this down into a singular action that answers the question, just ask yourself, are my words, actions, and behaviors today taking me closer to or further away from who I want to be and what I want in this world? And if that answer is further away, ask more questions and decide the pains you need to embrace.
It's time to ask yourself, when was the last time you prioritized you? Did you know that research shows that nearly 85% of high performers struggle to maintain a performance mindset while juggling the demands of work and personal life? Those who actively prioritize their performance mindset and personal growth are 30% more likely to achieve their goals in business and life. If you're feeling crippling stress and anxiety, or if you're feeling guilty when you take a moment for yourself, or if you're stuck in the grind and feeling burnt out, you're not alone. Many of us yearn for more, but struggle with the fear of being judged or feeling selfish. And you want to step into the next best version of yourself. That's why I created the Rinse Method, which got me from paraplegic to marathon runner. Backed by science-based proven strategies and now customized for high performers like you. If you're stuck and stressed and want clear steps that you can implement today to move forward, make sure you visit thepositivepersistence.com to download our free Rinse PDF.
So true. Man, you're preaching, Brian. You're preaching. I love it. I love it. Let's circle back a little bit because you mentioned the Waste to Wealth program. And that is something that when I first met you, that's kind of what we were talking about and tapping into. And you teach people how to take out their trash. And for most people listening and watching this, are probably like, well, what the hell does that mean? And when you first said that, that was my exact reaction. Like, what is he talking about? Take out your trash. So I was kidding you. Please break that down for us and what you mean by when you help people take out their trash, what we're actually doing there.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell it again through a story and an example because I think it's relevant that way. The first thing that I say, and I just will define it so that it's really clear out of the gate, the trash from your past is the emotional triggers, behavioral patterns, and environmental conditioning that have created a set of beliefs that your life is then only further validated. By the way, true or not. Okay, that's just part of what happens. And it happens to all of us, and it happens in really small, nuanced ways, and it can happen in really profound ways. But often these then create patterns and ways of living that become unconscious to us, and yet it's our fatal flaw, and the things that we think we've moved past, moved through, and yet they still show up, continuing to bite us. Right. So I didn't even realize the trash that I had for a long time. And I'll give you just a very clear element because I am a big believer in getting to the core, the source or sources of the trash so that we can start to move through it. The big piece that I want to say before I even jump in any further, though, because I'm not going to go through every single pillar in this, I'm just going to hit on the concepts and how it can manifest, is that I want each and every one of you to understand that one of the more fundamental elements of this is that you need to understand and embrace that the trash from your past is not your fault. It just becomes your responsibility once you become aware of it or you start burying others in yours. It's been generationally passed down. Trauma passes through the DNA. It's literally inherited at the cellular level, despite whatever life and environment you ended up coming into. But again, it is not your fault, but it does become your responsibility. So what did this look like for me? This is just one of the many arcs that I had to unpack for anger and shame. But when I came out of the hospital, what happened? I had a teddy bear in between my arm. I was this cute little seven-year-old that already had a little bit of gravity to him because that's just how I operated. And so inevitably, people would come up to me. And I wondered for years why questions were so important to me. And this is something I recently connected, actually, since the time you and I first met, and you've even heard me speak. Mm-hmm. Why do I care so much about questions? Well, I think it's because of the large number of people who would just stare and determine and write my story for me and never have the courage to ask. What happened to you or any other details? Right. And when someone doesn't ask a question to you, to meet you where you are, to get your context, your understanding, your perspective, they are literally stealing your voice and they are writing your story for you. Okay. So that was a huge portion of people. But then most people, when they would overcome that, because most people aren't afraid of a kid, they come up and what happened to you?
Right.
They're expecting me to say that I was racing my kid, my brother down the street on our bikes. I flew off a jungle gym or something else. And I'd look them deadpan in the eye. I was run over by a truck and my left arm was torn off. You said it earlier. It's like, man, my jaw hit the floor. But that's what I saw all the time at seven. People's jaws hit the floor. And then when they would pick them back up, most of them would pause and they'd turn to look at my parents for validation, which told me what? Now, most of the people didn't even ask a question or have the courage to ask a question. They're writing their stories for me. Now, these people asked a question. I told them the truth that I'm living and existing in, and they don't believe me.
Right.
I started to believe nobody's going to believe my truth, my statement. So why even represent it or show it? Why even go down that path? Because if I'm going to have to fight, justify, and defend who I am and what I've been through, man, that's no fun. So once they'd accept it, then they would pause and they would view me through their lens of what they'd be capable of in my situation, immediately limiting me even further, telling me all the things I was and wasn't going to be able to do for the rest of my life. I'll tell you, the number of reps that I went through that dynamic and that flow with people, it started to really shape my view of how I was going to interact. But what was I also told? Well, if you have a good mindset, Brian, you're going to be okay. I'm going to say this now as a little bit of a precursor. Mindset's only part of the equation, but it was my only equation for a long time. What was my mindset? Well, Brian's good. Brian's strong. Brian's capable. Brian can do anything himself. And what did I do? I lived my life largely for that next period of time to prove to everybody else all the things I was and wasn't going to be able to. And now I can look back on it and realize I was actually proving it to myself more than anybody.
Yeah.
At 20, I go down, I re-break my left arm in a snowboarding injury. I almost lose it again. I go 10 months with it hanging by my side, went through 7 surgeons who were afraid to touch me, and I got into the deepest, darkest depression I've ever been in my life. Why? Because I'd been surrounded by people in college, people that I'd been partying with, doing community service with, helping, doing things, leading. And no one was there. Nobody. Now then I was getting a little bit lonely. I was getting resentful. I was getting angry. Like all these people that I'd invested in, that I was showing up for, were not there to help me when I needed it most. So I had to surrender, accept the reality, the fact that the world just bought into the power of my own narrative. Brian's good. Brian's strong. Brian's capable. Brian can do anything himself. See, now they added a fifth layer to that I wasn't aware of, which is, oh, and Brian will ask for help if he needs it. But I didn't have the courage to even know how to ask for help at that time in my life. So I shift this a little further because, okay, now I'm starting to realize I'm really, really disconnected because of this pattern of protection that I put in place to keep myself okay. And I started to look at vulnerability and authenticity, which I defined as the glue that bound human connection at that time. But I also knew I wasn't clear in who I was and also who I wanted to be around, but I did have a healthy model for chasing what? What house, what car, what amount of money? So that's what I did. Started asking enough questions, sharing just enough about myself to get other people to open up, lower their walls so I could drive a Mack truck through and focus on their problems and still avoid my own. But I also built a successful business. By the age of 27, I had a $10 million business. I was practically printing money. I had all the house, the car, the money, all the things I ever thought I wanted. My bank account was full, but I found myself empty. And that was the beginning of realizing the shame and some of the components of the anger and how they were starting to impact my life. That was the moment I hired one of my first coaches, and actually my very first coach, and made some radical changes in my life. But it was still a few years before I had realized that there was a big missing piece. My daughter would, she and I were playing one day, and she wraps her arm around my neck and kisses me on the cheek. And she says, "I love you, Dada." She was 2 at this time. I was 32. And I started crying in pure joy. Now, I think that men crying is a sign of strength. And I think tears really are a healthy release. But I conditioned myself not to cry years ago. So it was a weird thing for me then. I've been relearning, by the way, since this time. But it was a weird thing for me because I'm feeling this huge, robust, powerful emotion. And it made me realize that pretty much every other emotion I'd ever felt paled in comparison. I started to realize how I was unconsciously but actively suppressing everything, immediately cutting off here when I would get a stimulus or a trigger and going up to here to perseveration thought, and it would just spin. So what did I connect the dots on in that period of time? That when I shut off physical pain because it exceeded my ability to cope when I was 7, I also shut off mental pain, emotional pain, and spiritual pain for 20 to 25 years, and I didn't realize it. Mm-hmm. Human connection without emotion is not human connection, period. And that opened up the whole next evolution of this piece. But where did waste to wealth come from? Well, waste to wealth came from the fact that I had to apply certain methodologies and thought processes in my own world that despite all the coaching, all the counseling, and one number I'm proud to flex, in the last 13 years, I've spent close to $1 million, invested close to $1 million in my own coaching, development, therapy, and otherwise, because that's something that I have gotten the greatest ROI on in my life. But how would it show up in my home? My wife would say something as simple as this: "Hey, honey, what do you want to do with the kids this weekend?" But my shame and my anger filter would cause me to hear it this way: "Hey, honey, you've not done enough to be a good husband and father this weekend or this week. So what are you going to do to make up for it this weekend?" Well, you better damn well believe I'm going to fucking protect the shit out of that because I'm a good husband. I'm a great father, right? And I'm going to rattle off the 10 things I've done in the last few days to show her I'm a good husband and father. Yeah. Can't even believe she'd challenge me on that. And that wasn't even what she asked. Mm-hmm. So now what have I done? I've created damage, which is going to take more time and energy for both of us to neutralize, diffuse, and create repair. That's also when I started to realize that the world will never judge you based on your intent. The world is and will only ever judge you based on what your words, actions, and behaviors communicate to them, even if you're unconscious to it. And so that misalignment, that lack of alignment between my intent and what my words, actions, and behaviors were communicating became the focus in really being able to unwind and get back to the components that were still causing me to react that way, right? The cellular memory that would activate in a moment when my wife would look at me, and it had nothing to do with her and everything to do with how my dad looked at me when I loaded the dishwasher incorrectly when I was 7. And so the truth of the matter is that the trash from your past are these components that carry forward. But it's also what shows up as one of the biggest limiting impacts for people to connect with themselves, connect with each other, connect to the lives, the dreams, the money that they believe that they can make, right? I work with a CEO of a $50 million logistics company, but he's a second gen owner. And the amount of shame that he had because his entire life was to live into the standard of what his father was. His father was considered to be a dictator in this business. And when he left, not only did the son purchase it with his own money and resources, but there became a void in this area. But what does that also mean? As CEO now, he literally questions every decision that gets made because of the level of criticism that he lived his entire life under and never knowing what was right until he got it wrong and got penalized for it. But the biggest limiting factor to so many businesses, people, fathers, wives, mothers, all of it. This is always the singular reason that people get stuck. It is never to do with the strategy and tactics. It is always to do with the trash from people's past, whether they're conscious to it or not.
That is so amazingly true. There are so many instances that I can think of in my own life that date back to or originated from my childhood in my past. And unfortunately, I had one of those fathers that I didn't have a good relationship with, and I didn't have a good, really, communication style or anything thereof with my father. And what you said is so important, I think, for people to realize that in a lot of ways, it's not a them problem or a it problem. It's a me problem. It's a us problem. Like
every time.
Yeah, every single time. And when you talk about you know, taking out the trash, I think it's so important for people to understand that. Like, I think, you know, the number one thing that stands in your way of success is you.
It's true. And that trash creates what we call waste in our lives and our businesses, right? Wasted time, wasted energy, wasted money, wasted opportunity, wasted systems, wasted clarity, wasted communication, wasted messaging. Because without intentionally aligning and understanding with clarity how these things all connect, these patterns show up in people's lives, in their health, in their wealth. And I mean that financially. It shows up in wasted time. It shows up in like horrible leadership situations where they actually lose everything within their business. Yeah. I mean, these are literally the fundamental pieces that keep us from having clarity and being able to have discernment in any situation. Because the second shame and blame or a reaction exists, growth and opportunity go out the window. And so this is the greatest investment I believe that almost anyone can make is actually in doing this work to better understand themselves, as well as to break the patterns that have kept them trapped and open them to the potential of what they really could live into without it.
Right. When we talk about, you know, stepping into that next best version of yourself and actually tapping into that potential, what are some easy steps that someone could take to even just to begin to realize that they're being held back by their past, by their trash?
So I think there's a variety of ways that we can approach this. I'm going to give two. The first is going to be a really simple exercise. And it's literally, I want every single one of you to create two lists. You can draw a T on a piece of paper, a line down the middle, and there's two lists. On one side of the list, I want you to write down all the people, places, sources of information, environments that you are a part of, activities that you do that leave you feeling uplifted. That you cannot wait to get back to see those people, do those things, be in those environments, that you could be there for an hour or 8 hours and it felt like one because you're in flow, you're loving it, you're invigorated, you have excitement, you shine light as a result of it. We all know what that feels like, but very few people I find put intention into putting themselves into the environments that produce that, right? So this is the first piece, okay? So here's that. And on this side of the list, write it all down, acknowledge it, everything you do in your life. The second side of the list, I want you to write down all the people, places, sources of information, environments, activities that leave you feeling depleted, defeated, unworthy. That you were there for 1 hour, but it felt like eight because you're just slamming your head against the wall and you cannot imagine getting back to see those people, be in those places and do those things. See, what I find is that there's a staggering amount of people who live their lives largely on the negative side of the list and they do nothing about it. They don't even ask the questions or challenge it or refine it or remove themselves. And guess what? If you have things that are connected to your past and you have stagnation in your life in any other direction, it's going to show up in all of these areas, right? Do you go back and see your family once a week? And every time you go back and see your family, you feel shitty about yourself and they don't believe in you and they don't invest in you. Is it you go out to networking events and everybody wants something from you instead of for you, and you start to wall up and retreat because it's the same type of feeling as when you aren't understood or seen in a different environment, right? Like, this can show up in so many different ways, but this exercise gives people the ability to at least see it with clarity. And what I tell people is to reduce, eliminate, remove, refine, repair the elements on the negative side of the list wherever they possibly can, and spend as much on the positive side as they possibly can. Why? Because that's what you light up about. That's where your energy is called to. But you're the one who still has to choose to create the environments that you spend time in, the areas that make you feel good, feel seen, feel safe, and feel protected. Mm-hmm. The secondary piece that I would say is that I think almost everybody can identify with this idea of how we tend to protect ourselves in moments when we don't feel seen, understood, and connected. And so if we look at this through this nature, I would just say, look, like, we all seek and desire four things. We all want to feel safe. We all want to feel protected. We all want to feel seen and understood, and we all want to feel connected. But again, the second we don't have those things, or we don't feel safe and protected, we protect ourselves. So imagine like a 35-gallon black trash bag that you're going to hold up over your face. You've seen me do this exercise real time. In fact, you helped me with it, right? In this room. But now if we hold it up in front of our face, it becomes an opaque force field that we can actually have a visual around. Then the question becomes, if you're in a protectionary state, how could you ever expect your most intimate relationships, your wife, your kids, your partners, your family, your clients, the closest relationships, to see who you are, what you're willing to do, what you're not willing to do, your heart, your intent, your soul, your desires, your boundaries, your value, your worth, delivered through this opaque force field? See, the truth of the matter is that most people can understand and identify when they're in a triggered state or in a protective state. But most do nothing about it, even though it completely separates them from everything. Because what we know is that the second you protect yourself, you guarantee you're actually going to disconnect yourself from who you are and what you want. And the second you protect yourself, you're actually going to disconnect yourself from the two things in those four that you want most, which is to be seen and understood and connected at the deepest level. And so there are processes to allow you to start to recognize how to lower those. There's ways that we can unpack it over time, but to make it tangible and real in this moment is, how often are you living in that protective, that retreat state, that armored or a guarded area within your life, whether it's in your business, with your relationships, with anybody? How often are you feeling that lower frequency shame and blame, or that need, that fear, that lack, that scarcity? Because when you're existing in that state, you are in a protective state. And when you are in a protective state, again, you disconnect from anything else that you want for yourself or within your life. And so in the most basics, I taught the concept at the highest level. But the question becomes, how often are you existing in a state that's actually disconnecting you from who you are and what you want? And if you can answer that, start to put a systematic process, and I can help you to get more clarity on it beyond that, on how to actually flip that dynamic so that, again, you're spending time with the people, the places, the activities, and the environments that leave you uplifted, mm-hmm. and that you do so in a way that you're actually open, available to receive, and stepping fully into all of what you're capable of.
Brian, you mentioned that most of the people that you deal with or you've seen live in the left side of that list, in that protective state that you're talking about. Why do you feel that is? Why do you feel that we have to have our armor on all the time? And why is it not flipped where we are in that state of being connected to things that we want, so we are who we want to be? And I don't know if it all comes down to vulnerability, but why is it that we are more prone to be on the left side than right side?
As fucked up and as simple as it can sound, it's because we live in a really fucked up world, right? Like, let's think about what happens, right? You have kids. I have kids. Anybody who's got kids or been one understands this. We are born as our brightest, most authentic burning light that will ever be. And then what happens? Parents, teachers, coaches, employers start saying, you should do this. You shouldn't do that. You should want this. You shouldn't want that. You should live here. You shouldn't live there. You should make this amount of, you shouldn't make this amount of money. You should drive this, have this kind of heart. And here's the reality. Should is a shame-based word that implies whoever you are and whatever you're doing, it's not good enough. So largely in our lives, what do? We start to funnel and condition ourselves to live with inside the box of who the world has told us who to be, because we perceive that as safe. If we can be who the world has told us who to be with all these other restrictions, then we're going to be okay. We're going to be valued. We're going to be understood. We're going to be seen. But inherently, what's actually happening by doing that is that to live inside that box, that is your armor. That is your protection. Mm-hmm. Which also means that who you are inside slowly dies. And part of this is coming back to getting people back to the core of who they are. But it makes sense, because even those who say, man, I had a really privileged, blessed upbringing, often will be able to identify down into a moment where it was a girlfriend, or they started to play in sports and they learned to receive love, validation, and connection through performance, which meant I'm going to go perform. I'm going to go perform because why? I get love, validation, and connection. But what does that also do? It trains and conditions many of us high performers to actually believe that our value and our worth is contingent upon what we do instead of who we are. So these are variables that start to shape us, and trauma or not, it doesn't really matter. Whether it's a big T or a little T trauma, these are micro moments that cause a set of beliefs. Like I said, it could be as simple as growing up in a household like I did, and I mean this with the greatest amount of respect, where there was one right way to do every single thing. But I didn't always know what that right way was until I got in trouble for it, right? And so if you look at even how we condition and raise our kids, we don't teach people to think. We don't teach people to feel. We don't teach people to reason. We don't teach people to tap into their emotions. Why? Because the world tells us to show up, put a smile on, and push through at all costs. The world perpetuates the message of performance. But what happens when we perpetuate the message of performance is that we also perpetuate disconnection at a level that keeps us living in a way that's isolated and alone. When in reality, we all want to be connected. Right. But even look at how it shows up in the world, in religion, in politics, in everything. There is divisive behavior designed to put people into camps to feel good or not feel good. It's either right or it's wrong. We live in this binary world. And yet that's typically not what actually is real. And so I think that it is coming from a place of power and control. And power and control are both in places to design or believe that they are designing safety. When in reality, power and control actually do not create safety. They take us further away from it. And so even in today's landscape, we can see how some of this is taking place. We're seeing narratives and messages that are around creating safety for people. But what is it actually doing? It's actually creating even more separation, because it's suggesting and creating narratives that other people are not equal to or safe or capable of connecting with us because of where they look, what amount of money they make, or otherwise. And so it's all around us. So the only way to escape it is to put in the time and, to your point, have the courage to start asking some of those questions and deciding, how do I want to align my life, my values, my words, actions, and behaviors so that I'm in alignment with who I am, what I value, and can get who I am and what I want out of this world. But what does it require? A lot of work. Because to get to what I call the protector and connector, which requires a strong spine and a soft front, it means, as a strong spine, I know who I am, what I'm willing to do, what I'm not willing to do, my heart, my intent, my soul, my desires, my value, my boundaries, my worth delivered, right? So that I can be unwavering in any environment. And I always think about this strong spine. Have you seen the movie 8 Mile?
Yeah.
It's like that last rap battle with Eminem when he's like, I did grow up from across the tracks. My buddy Bob did shoot himself, blah, blah, blah. And he just rattles everything off. But here's the truth. We have to work to get so clear and so confident in who we are that we have nothing to justify, protect, or defend about ourselves. Mm-hmm. Just like Eminem, when he dropped the mic at the end of that, what did his competition have on him? Nothing. All the things that they'd use to create insecurity, make him feel bad about himself, beat him in these rap battles up until that moment, he's like, I've accepted it all. This is who I am, right? And they couldn't come at him for anything else. So with that strong spine, it then allows us to be, whether we're doing it fabricated in a moment or it starts to become the way we live, to lower that armor. And I think about my wife and my kids when I think about this soft front. Right? When they want love, light, leadership, laughter, coming to dad, do they want to lay their head down on a metal chest piece of armor? No. They want me. They want my heart. They want my connection. And so here's the reality. You have to live in an unprotected state the majority of your life, or learn to live in an unprotected state the majority of your life, to actually allow yourself to receive and exist in abundance and connection. But here's the kicker, and this is what most people have a hard time wrapping their heads around. When I encourage and teach people to live in an unprotected state, that does not mean that you cannot or will not protect yourself and those you love if you absolutely have to, right? It is about understanding and knowing that in your worth, in your ability, that you can and will protect yourself and those you love in the situations that you need to. But it's not living in a protective state, anticipating that that's going to be your constant reality in every given moment. It's actually the exception and the few and far between moments that you need to take action there. But it's both. To live unprotected, you need to know how to protect. But at the end of the day, if you live protected, you also guarantee you're going to live disconnected. That's not the life I wanted.
Man, I don't even know how to sum all this up, Brian. You have dropped so much wisdom and knowledge and clarity. But I think that people need to hear your message more. They need to understand exactly what you're saying, and they understand that they really need to get themselves out of their own way to be able to tap into that strong spine and that soft front. So can you tell us, viewers, listeners, where we can get more of Brian Boger, where we can find out more about what you teach, what you coach, and how we can get more information about what you talk about?
If you're a social media person, I'm at Bogert Brian on any and all channels, and on our path to impact over a billion lives as quickly as we can by reducing the level of suffering that exists on this planet, I realize that 99.9% of you are never going to pay me a dollar. We put out a lot of free resources for that purpose because, as I told you before, move people, move people. If you heard something today, you see something on social or anything, I want you to move it in yourself and move it through your world and the people that you can impact, because that's the ripple effect that helps us get there. If you are online, you can go to brianbogert.com. You can also check out flippingthelid.com, which is our podcast where we normalize a lot of these different conversations. And you'll see some of the most successful, influential, and impactful people from this world having breakthrough moments in this conversation around the trash or the waste that still shows up in their worlds, so that you also can feel normalized and have tangible ways to move yourself through it. At the end of the day, man, I care about impact first. And so every way that I live, even if it's just a brief introductory conversation, is about how do I help the person that's in front of me? So if there's interest, intrigue, or a way to explore, I encourage you guys to go check it out. And if you want to have a conversation, there's ways to set that up as well. Just let us know, because that's what we're here for.
And now you guys can see why my jaw was on the floor when I first heard Brian Boger speak. He is an amazing human being with an amazing mind. So Brian, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And I want to thank all of our listeners and our viewers for tuning in. And we're going to wrap this up like we always do, is that remember to stay positive, stay persistent, and know that mindset is everything. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for tuning in and being part of the Positive Persistence family. We're having a great time creating this content, and we truly hope it inspires you to embrace positivity and persistence in your own journey. If this podcast episode inspired you or entertained you, scroll down, hit those stars, and leave a comment or two. Your 5-star reviews and shares encourage us and help us grow the show. So until next time, stay positive, stay persistent, and remember, mindset is everything.